The labor bill.
They did.
Truth.
House Transportation will come to order. Hopefully, a few more people will join us before we're done, but I think we are going to be down a couple. And so, welcome. It is.
And it happens.
I heard some committee chairs saying the date. Me, I wouldn't remember what the date was, so I'm trying not to get myself into any more trouble than I have to. So, we'll go ahead. We have two informational hearings today. One is, the first one, I'll open a public hearing on the recycled asphalt shingles. And Mr. Tendall and Mrs. Hunt. Ms. Hunt.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Doug Tendall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Glad to be here today to talk about two issues that I think are of great importance to the transportation sector in Oregon. So we brought along some folks who are the experts in the area. The first one we're going to talk about is the use of recycled shingles in asphalt concrete pavement. And Liz Hunt, ODOT's pavements engineer, will be giving that presentation. And then we'll talk about seismic vulnerabilities in our bridges. As Mr. Brennan pointed out, it would be great if we could just use recycled shingles in bridges to strengthen them for seismic vulnerability. Unfortunately, that's a challenge that the engineering community has not yet figured out a way to apply. But we'll tell you about these two things separately, and hopefully spur some, tell you how we've taken on these good ideas and hopefully spur some discussion. So with that, I'll turn the first presentation over to Liz.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Liz Hunt, and I'm the ODOT Pavement Services Engineer. I'm here today to talk about ODOT's recent study on the use of recycled asphalt shingles in asphalt concrete pavement, which was advanced in response to House Bill 2733. Just a little bit of background about shingles. So you can see shingles are very common in the United States. About 11 million tons of asphalt shingle waste are generated every year. The majority of that are tear-offs, so that's when you get your house re-roofed. Those shingles go somewhere, and about 90% of the material generated is the tear-off. So there's a lot of potential. Now, shingles are a lot like asphalt concrete pavement because they include both asphalt cement and sand. So asphalt concrete pavement is aggregate and asphalt cement. So what I'd like to talk today about is the OSU study, which includes looking at using RAS, or recycled asphalt shingles, in pavements. And actually, I should have renamed that title, as the actual study is Preliminary Investigation of RAP and RAS. We got a lot of acronyms in HMAC, which is hot mix asphalt concrete. So if you remember those three, you'll be fine. So RAP is recycled asphalt pavement material, and that is what's generated when a portion of our road is ground up, and that material is incorporated back into a new pavement. So it's similar to RAS in that it's aggregate with oil, but because it was designed for a different purpose, your roof, it's different than what's designed to go on the road. So those materials have different properties. So from there, I'll talk about the current state of practice using RAP in pavements, which is relevant to this study. And then we'll talk about the initial findings and the course of action that ODOT plans to do. In general, the OSU study is looking at using both RAP and RAS. Again, we current state of the practice uses a fair amount of RAP in our pavements. So just to step back a little bit, I need to talk about pavements in general. So asphalt pavements are made up of, as I mentioned, asphalt and aggregate. And the asphalt cement is the binder, the glue that holds the rock together, and it provides some durability. Along with holding the pavement together, the binder gives the pavement stiffness so that when it's hot, it doesn't rut, and when it's cold, it's flexible and doesn't crack. So as simple as that sounds, the mixture is precisely designed and controlled to achieve the most economical result in terms of longevity and performance. We know that the binder used to make shingles is much stiffer than that used in paving. So if we incorporated too much of the shingles, we could get pavements that aren't durable, that could crack before their life cycle has run out. So going back to the study that OSU did, because ODOT currently allows RAP, which also has some used binder in it, we needed to look at how to continue allowing RAP while also incorporating the RAS. So a study was set up to look at the physical properties of the binder, the asphalt, and the RAP and RAS, incorporating them with virgin or new materials. So our goal was to determine how much does the incorporation of RAS change the material properties of the mixes. So with the results, we can make more responsible decisions so that we can make sure our pavements are going to last for a long time. And then we can move forward with a pilot study. So more about RAP. We actually have been using RAP in our pavements for probably 20 years, and we see good performance from the pavements constructed. So we use as much as 30% of the recycled material that's generated on a project. Not every project generates RAP, but the majority do. So we're able to reuse the materials to a beneficial use at a cost-effective price. So the materials obtained at the project site and reused in the same location. So at the current price of asphalt at $500 a ton, if we use up to 30% recycled asphalt pavement, we could see a savings of anywhere from $5 to $7 a ton, just incorporating RAP. So, you know, you talk about how that savings seen, I think we'll see it in our bid prices. And certainly this last year, we saw very favorable bid prices. And I think if we look closely, we probably see more favorable bid prices on projects incorporating RAP than those not.
Quickly, as I look at these two numbers, does the amount of construction that has been going on, is that the increase in what
yes.
you're using?
2009, we saw an increase. Well, obviously, we doubled our paving with the ARRA program.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you help me get my arms around what 450,000 tons equates to in terms of miles of highway, or is it a lot?
Yes. So a typical project, let's say I-5, Tualatin, Wilsonville. No, let's talk about I-405. If you've driven I-405, that project was about 9,000 tons.
Wow.
So if you've driven that recent paving.
Wow.
So this is significant.
Wow. Thank you.
So big projects might have 50,000 tons on it. So this would be equivalent, if we paved it all with RAP, would be 9 projects.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
I included this slide just to kind of give you a visual image about what happens when we don't get the binders right. So you can see on the left the pavement is rutting, which is part due to the asphalt binder being too soft. And then on the right you can see that the pavement's cracked. And if you've ever driven Highway 97, and hopefully not recently, but years back it was cracked, and when you drove it would go thump, 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 because you'd have very uniform crack spacing. And what happens is when pavements get really cold, they actually contract, and as they pull apart, they crack. And so you'll see this uniform crack spacing. If the binder, I said, too soft, will get rutting too hard, then it'll crack. But also there are issues with construction. If we make it too stiff, it's very hard for the contractors to get it placed, to build it very uniform, to get it compacted well so that it'll be durable. So there's a couple issues we really need to be concerned with when we start incorporating stiffer binders. The OS2 study was initiated to evaluate the impacts of incorporating both RAP and RAS. So we started the study by looking at the properties of just virgin binder, and then also the properties of the binder removed from the recycled asphalt shingles. Then we looked at incorporating both of these materials with the aggregate, mixing it, and then pulling them back apart to see how the properties changed. You can imagine if you look A plus B equals C, when you mix them together, you might get A plus B equals D. The properties change because there's difference in the timing of mixing, the interaction with the aggregate. So a whole host of things can happen. So we needed to look where's ground zero and then what happens when we mix them. So once we had the properties of the binders, then we could compare them and see how much of the properties changed. The initial findings indicate that using recycled asphalt shingles could cause a pavement that's too stiff. Now this is, to be honest, a bit of an anomaly, because we're not quite sure why just shingles alone would be a problem. So it would be something we'd look at in a pilot study. The study also found that no change in binder properties with 10% RAP and 5% recycled asphalt shingles would give us really no significant change in our binder properties, so we could get the same performance we've been seeing. Now, if we go further and we continue with our 30% RAP, which is our standard of practice, but also add 5% RES, then again, we're back into potential for pavements that are hard to place, hard to construct, and also that could crack when it's cold. I thought this was another way to look at the data that will give you an indication. The two yellow areas are yellow arrows are our baseline. So that was the original binder test. And you can show the top one, it says that at minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit, this pavement or this asphalt shouldn't crack. And so anytime we shift that arrow to the right, then that means it's not going to be have the properties necessary for when it gets really cold. So we want to make sure that whatever we produce is pretty close to the original binder that was designed or that was specified for that project. With the results that we found from the study, we're planning two pilot projects. These are planned this construction season, one east side, one west side. We're trying to look at where we might have access to the shingles. We'll require that the pavements incorporate 5% recycled asphalt shingles and allow up to 20% RAP. So the contractor might opt to only use 10%. It depends on how much binder we're actually getting from each of those materials. And then we'll monitor that pilot project for construction issues and performance for at least 2 years. So it'll give us an idea of how do we make sure we're getting the properties we want, how do we make sure that the materials are incorporated into the mix during construction and placed properly. So we'll look at modifying our specifications. And in the future, we've got another study going, so we might actually be modifying the original binder that we specify in anticipation of making this product stiffer. So we're not doing that now, but we might perhaps in the future. And I know other states across the country have done that. We'll also be modifying our testing procedures, how the mix is designed before it gets on the ground, and determining the binder content of the recycled asphalt shingles, which, amazingly enough, is a process even in itself, almost a project, to make sure that we get that right. And then from there, we'd like to move into allowing RAS in pavement. So let the market drive it. Make it a permissive specification. So if the contractor is going to get a benefit from it, we can manage it to be responsible and get good performance in our pavements, then there's no reason we shouldn't allow it. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that there is potential for savings using recycled asphalt shingles and pavements. So with 5% materials, we can save $1 to almost $3 a ton, and that's just an estimate based on current asphalt prices. I'm sure Doug can relate to this. We were monitoring asphalt prices a couple years ago when it went from about $300 at the beginning of the season and topped out at $1,000 at the end of the season. So as that price of asphalt increases, we're going to see more demand for some of these recycled products. So I just put for 1 million tons, which is our normal paving season, that could be $1 million to almost $3 million a year. Any questions?
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are they going to turn the lights back on? Okay. I'm scared. saving money, recycling, keeping stuff out of our landfills, we're win-win here, and you were already doing that. I appreciate that. As you know, I had a constituents come forward with this bill last year, which generated this conversation, and we were told you're having the study anyway. That's a pretty radical increase in the amount of material you're using. And on a side note, I had a person who had a business in Eugene, and it's a question for DEQ, I think, more than anything. I don't know what he was or wasn't doing, but they shut him down. He was grinding up shingles. I'm interested in following up on that. But
you can check with me, too.
Okay.
He's in Springfield.
Okay. All right, Madam Chair.
Was in Springfield.
Yes, ma'am. I will follow up with you for sure. Do you see that trend? I think it was 290 or 250 to 450,000 tons. How long will that trend continue? It'll make a difference on what your binder and all that makes up. But is that trend up going to continue as long as we're spending money on paving at the rate we are? And I hope we're not importing any of this material from out of state. Do we have enough in this state? And would it be, whether it's my constituent or some other folks, do you think it would be worthwhile for someone to go into business grinding this stuff up and providing you with that material? Not going on there, Doug.
I'll take a shot at those six or eight questions that you asked there. Chair Byer, Representative Schaffler, the last year was somewhat of an anomaly. How many tons did we put down last year?
2 million.
2 million tons because of our stimulus money. Our usual year is about 1 million tons.
Right.
We're trying to hold the line on that and continue that level of paving. In terms of the materials that come in, almost all the rocks from Oregon, almost all of an asphalt concrete that we put down is from Oregon. There's a couple of plants in California, some in Washington. So if you're working on the border, you might get a bidder that's running it out of there, or Idaho on the east side. But most of it is made in Oregon. And in terms of the shingles, I've been told that a couple of paving companies are starting to buy at least the waste material, not the tear-offs, but at least the waste material, and starting to stockpile it. I think that as Liz said, as you get into the higher cost of asphalt, the folks that are building the pavements are looking for anything that can decrease those costs. And so I think you're already seeing people who think that's a viable way to do it. They're looking at every opportunity to do it. And the transport costs, just like in aggregate, the transport costs are high. So it doesn't seem to me that it's going to be really viable for them to truck those things across the country. I think you're going to get the local products, whether they're tear-off or the waste material from the new shingles. It seems like that's going to be pretty local. So I think it hits that target that you said about keeping stuff out of our landfills.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I really appreciate you following up on this. And I just have to comment on one thing, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Doug said,
yes, follow up.
We import gravel into this state from Washington, and I'm not blaming you. And we import logs to keep our mills going. So importing anything in bulk would be, and we may soon start to import cement from China if we're not already. Nothing surprises me, Doug. I don't think we need to import any of this material. I don't think we need to import any more gravel. I think we can produce our cement in this state. I don't think we should ever, it's criminal, we import logs into the state. And I'll shut up, Madam Chair. You've heard it all before. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience.
You're very welcome. Representative Schaffler, other questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there variation in the shingles, pretty dramatic, or you've seen one shingle, you've seen them all?
But that's a good question, and we have not been monitoring that, but no, there is variation, and a couple of things I've found just from other states doing this, there's a significant difference from residential shingles versus commercial shingles. Commercial shingles you want to stay away from. The age is going to affect the binder properties, so that's another piece that will be, as we get into this more and more, we'll be looking to how do we make sure we're getting a uniform product and that we're evaluating the properties when we incorporate it properly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there a way of ascertaining at this early date whether or not this whole exercise is worth the effort? Because just as Representative Schaffler indicates, there would be great enthusiasm for taking this product and making money, but if there's only $4 million to be made on a million tons of asphalt, I'm not sure the profit is there. So I'm just wondering, is this exercise designed as a device for us to get rid of these shingles, some way to just get rid of them as opposed to putting them into a landfill, and thus there's going to be a government subsidy necessary to make that happen? Or is there actually enough profit in there from what you guys are seeing that make this whole effort you're going through worthwhile?
Chair Byer, Representative Benz, I think that if we go to a permissive spec, specifications, in other words, we don't require it, but we allow it, then the market will indeed drive that. We'll find that out. My personal opinion is I don't see the liquid asphalt cost going down, and you're going to see contractors looking for every possible way they can get asphalt at a lower price than $500 or $600 or $700 a ton.
Well, thank you for that. I was just looking at the for 1 million tons of asphalt concrete placed annually, $1 million to $2.8 million in savings. Is that based on a current asphalt price of something that's anticipated to double or triple?
Chair Byer, Representative Benz, there's a, I got a, this is going to get a little bit murky, or hopefully not murky, but when we talk about $500 a ton for asphalt, we're talking about the actual binder itself, the black stuff. That's about 6% of what goes into a pavement. So your pavement, your in-place pavement cost is, I don't know, what are we getting, $40 a ton?
Yes.
So your in-place pavement cost is $38 or $40 a ton. So that's really where you need to be comparing that dollar a ton savings or $2.80 a ton savings is against the total mix cost. So it's a little bit bigger percentage than you than it would seem when we talk about asphalt, the actual binder cost being $500 or $600 a ton.
I'm just trying. Thank you again for that. I was just trying to get at how much money a person might hope to make if all these studies turn out right when they take a roof off someplace and begin to grind it up and haul it down to the local plant.
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, I think in the competition we have in Oregon currently, and hopefully we have enough work to keep folks from going out of business, but the competition we have currently is enough for contractors to really look for fairly marginal differences in cost. In other words, if they can bid in-place asphalt concrete at $38 a ton on a 50,000-ton job, and this gives them the opportunity to bid it at $37 a ton or $36.50 a ton, that's enough, I believe, for a contractor to say, hey, if I employ this stuff, I can actually win the bid as opposed to not winning the bid. So, you know, time will tell, but by making it a permissive spec, we don't run the risk of saying that we're subsidizing it because the business sector is going to drive whether or not they get used. My personal opinion is that it will get used.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was my memory when we discussed this last time that Oregon's a little ahead of the curve on this information. In other words, other states aren't studying this. Or would you remind me of what other states are doing in this venue? And
sure. The Oregon's ahead of the curve in using recycled asphalt pavement.
Mm-hmm.
Other states in the country use recycled asphalt shingles, but the post-manufactured waste, because it's more uniform. You know what properties you're going to get. You know where it comes from. There has been a push in the last few years to look at the tear-offs because of the price of asphalt escalating. So I know Minnesota just published a report. There's a national pooled fund study looking at the tear-offs. So that is very recent. So we're right in there with everybody else and timing on that.
I mention this because this is, you know, one of the ways that some of the federal government folks could help to provide the research to states to, you know, drive this in a more cogent manner and give good data without us in each state going on their own to try and study these things. And weather patterns and climate impact here, but I think this is one of the areas where the federal government could set some standards that and do some proactive testing that would help us all a lot.
I just
can't remember if a year ago you also addressed tires, and what's the tires are entirely different. What's the story on tires, just in 30 seconds?
Oh, thanks, Doug. So, 30 seconds. ODOT's use of recycled rubber is very, very minimal. We have a binder we use in chip seals that includes 5% recycled tire rubber. The state of the practice on rubber is, if we were to specify it, it would cost us a premium currently. And there are places where it shows beneficial use, but not enough to warrant, at least in Oregon, us to specify it for that extra cost. So that's the 30 seconds. There's much more, but
yeah,
okay.
Thank you. Well, and I'm math has never been my big suit, so I can say that. But now you have been using 30% wrap in a mix.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So if we're looking at, in your study, something that calls for 10% RAP and 5% RAS, it seems to me like we're not using the volume of recycled materials, so the savings has to be less. Is that, is my logic going in the right direction?
Yes, that would be correct. Oh my gosh. I'm sorry.
Me.
Saved by the bell. Yeah.
That is correct. But what it would do is allow more recycled materials available for more projects. So only using, maybe using less per job, but using more on more jobs.
Okay, that makes sense.
And Chair Byer, recycled asphalt pavement has other uses besides just combining, recombining it into pavement too. It's a pretty desirable product.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Just one more thing. I was trying to remember all of Representative Shoffler's questions, and I forgot to note that the constituent that brought this forward, Representative Shoffler's constituent that brought this forward, participated in the technical advisory committee for this research project. And I want to thank that gentleman because, you know, research is, Representative Berger alludes to, you know, it costs money to do research, and he wasn't getting paid. He was there as a volunteer. So a lot of people put in their own time on research projects, and Representative Shoffler, that gentleman stepped up and devoted some time to this.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you for coming in and your first appearance before the committee. And I'll go close the public information meeting on recycled RAS, right? I'll have to. And open a public hearing on the seismic vulnerability of our state highway bridges. So I open that public hearing.
Chair Byer, again, for the record, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director. For this presentation, Bruce Johnson, our bridge engineer, will provide you some information that came out of a study that recently was completed. And I think as you look through the study, you think, why didn't we know about this sooner? Bruce will talk about some of the new modeling tools that are available that allow us to better estimate what's going to happen in the event of what is probably a near certainty, a large seismic event. Bruce comes to us with a long, good bridge history. He worked for the FHWA for a number of years before coming to us, and we're fortunate to have him. So, Bruce, I'll turn that over to you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Chair Byer and members of the committee, I'm Bruce Johnson, the state bridge engineer in the highway division of ODOT, and I'm really happy to be here today to relay some of our concerns about seismic risk of highway bridges in Oregon, and as Doug said, to report on a recent research project that we've been working with Portland State University for a couple of years now. And right up front, I'm showing you some pictures here of one of our bridges, and the reason I wanted to put these right on the title slide was to introduce a concept called seismic retrofit. It's a type of work that ODOT has been doing for the last few years. And the Markham Bridge turned out to be one of our highest priority bridges to receive seismic retrofit. This was done in 1996. And I'm showing you a slide from underneath the Markham Bridge, and just to point out these cables that connect the upper part of the bridge where you actually drive on the structure, this floor system here, and these cables connect to the concrete that actually supports the bridge. And that's one of the processes we use in seismic retrofitting. This is one we call phase one. It's just to connect the different parts of the bridge together so that when an earthquake happens and the ground starts moving, those cables prevent the parts from coming apart and falling down into the river. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about seismic retrofit, but I just wanted to introduce that concept right up front. Here's a slide that shows probably the most important seismic source that we have in Oregon, because it has the potential for causing the highest damage. This is called the Cascadia Subduction Zone, and there's actually a fault out in the ocean where material's coming up from the interior of the Earth and causing the ocean floor basically to spread apart. And that's forcing this Juan de Fuca plate to be pushed underneath the North American plate, or basically underneath Oregon. And in the eons past, this phenomenon is what's caused the volcanoes and the Cascade Range to form. But they also cause earthquakes when those plates move suddenly or jolt. And so I just wanted to explain that phenomenon as one of the sources of seismic events that we have in Oregon. There's actually three main sources of seismic events. The one that causes the least damage is called the crustal earthquakes. And we have 15 to 20 of those every year in Oregon. Probably most people never know they occur. They're small movements. But they can cause problems because they have a potential for magnitude 5 or 6. And we've actually had a couple of these in the recent past. In 1993, there was one up in the North Valley centered at Scotts Mills. And in that same year, we had one down in Klamath Falls. In each one of those earthquakes, there was one bridge that was damaged. It had to be closed for a while until it could be repaired. And in the case of the Klamath Falls earthquake, there was actually a rock fall associated with that, too, that caused an injury accident on Oregon Highway 42. The second type of sources that we have for earthquakes is called intraplate, and that's an earthquake that's centered in that, say, Juan de Fuca plate that's down underneath Oregon. And this can have a potential of a magnitude 6 to 7. And we actually had one of those fairly recently last year down in Grants Pass. It was a 4.1. Fortunately, no highway infrastructure was damaged during that quake. And here's the interplate, or the subduction zone, and that's the one that slide just previously had referred to. The one that we're interested in because it has the potential for some very serious damage in Oregon. The example there, the last one that we know about, we learned from the scientists at the Department of Oregon Mineral Industries and Geology, Dogami, occurred in around 1700. And that was an 8.3 magnitude earthquake. Not a lot of damage because there wasn't a lot of people here then. One of the reasons we're concerned about this subduction zone earthquake is because the scientists tell us that a very large one is going to happen on a 300 to 500 year frequency. And of course, if the last one occurred in 1700, you can see that we're getting close to potentially another very large damaging earthquake. In fact, one of the reasons that we undertook this latest study was we have learned from Dogami that because of some of the activity that's taking place around the perimeter of that Juan de Fuca plate, they now estimate that it's greater than an 80% chance that we're going to have a very large earthquake in Oregon within the next 50 years. They think it will probably be centered down on the South Oregon coast. So with that kind of risk facing us, you can see that ODOT has been considering possible mitigation for that kind of widespread damage. We've thought about three different things that could be done. The first one is what I introduced at the very beginning, this retrofitting of our existing bridges. It turns out that we have approximately 2,500 bridges on the state system. And fortunately, there's about 1,600 of them that are in low-risk areas or have been constructed since 1990. When we started doing modern seismic design, and those bridges that have been constructed in the last 20 years are adequate for all seismic forces that we know of. But that leaves on the order of 900 that are what we consider a high priority for retrofitting. The second possible thing we could do is just replace those bridges. And fortunately, we have made a significant improvement in our seismic adequacy of our bridges because of the OTIA program, which started about 5 years ago. And we have replaced 150 bridges with seismically adequate bridges in that program. And we've retrofitted six that were included as repair bridges in that program. So we made some improvement because of that. But in general, the funding for the bridge program will not allow replacement of those bridges. It would be really literally hundreds of years before we could replace all the seismically poor bridges. And of course, the third thing we thought about is we should be prepared for recovery in case there is a very large event. And we do, ODOT has detailed plans in all five of our regions to send first responders out and identify which bridges are damaged, basically close those roads with the idea of basically a life safety situation where we would not allow people to drive over unsafe bridges. So we are prepared to do that. The problem, though, if we had a large spread, large event like that, is it would be very, very costly, both in damage to the highway system and because of loss of mobility. There would be a severe economic impact if when this large event occurs. To talk a little bit more about retrofit, in order to be cost-effective and do as many bridges as we could, we are doing it in a phased approach. In this phase one, we call life safety. And what that means is that we're adding those cables that I showed, which basically holds the bridge together so it doesn't completely collapse, which would potentially kill people on the bridge or underneath. And it's fairly economical to do that. The problem is that even though it does work for life safety, the bridge would not be usable after a seismic event, so you would still have lots of economic impact. Phase two is what we call serviceability, and that means that we do more work on the bridge to actually make it serviceable, and our target for that is within 72 hours after a major event, we would be able to inspect the bridge and do minor repairs, and it would be serviceable after that. The problem is that phase two cost about 4 to 5 times more than phase one, and we really have not been actively doing phase two in Oregon up to this point. Just to talk a little bit more about this retrofit concept, I'm showing you a schematic of a bridge, and you can see here's the riding surface where the cars travel, and typically that would be supported by some kind of girders underneath. The girders are supported by this cap, and then carried down to the columns into a foundation, which is basically below the ground, and you can't really see it, but it's a very important part of a bridge. What happens when you have a seismic event? There's two kinds of movements that occur in the ground. The ground starts going back and forth sideways, and also there's some up and down movement. And so you can just imagine looking at this kind of construction. If you don't have adequate connections between these members, the seismic forces would cause the members to move and shift around, and those girders would actually fall off the cap and collapse. So that's what we try to prevent when we do the phase one retrofitting. Here's a slide that shows you some of the concepts we use in retrofitting, and you can see this is a little different type of bridge. This is more like a freeway overpass structure similar to 217 Cruiseway over I-5 up in Portland, for instance, or some of the new structures at the Beltline down in Eugene. But the concept is the same. You can see the cables connecting this riding surface or deck or the girders to the column to keep the bridge from shifting one way or another and falling down. When we get into phase two, I wanted to just explain a little bit about why we do phase two. Older bridges designed before 1990 have large reinforcing steel inside the column, and it's sufficient to hold up the bridge. But we didn't know until several earthquakes occurred down in California that those bars would buckle and bend under an earthquake. And it's a simple solution if you're building a new bridge. This shows what we do on new bridges. We take some reinforcing steel and simply wrap it, around the steel, and that's sufficient to prevent it from buckling. So the bridge does not sway back and forth and become unusable. Now, if you don't have a chance to do that in new construction, one way to mitigate that or retrofit for it is shown here, where we put the steel on the outside of the concrete column, and that contains the concrete and prevents it from failure. So that's what phase two is, and it costs, like I said, significantly more than phase one. Okay, so what has ODOT done over the last 16 years? We basically knew about this situation in the mid-90s when we hired CH2M Hill to do a statewide prioritization of all of our bridges so we could potentially begin doing some retrofit. And first of all, in 94, they did the state highway bridges only. And then in 1997, we went back and included all of the local agency, city and county bridges, in this prioritization. Now, one of the things that came out of that study was we identified 1,155 bridges that were high priority for this retrofit. This would potentially give us a basic highway network that would be usable within 72 hours after an event. We actually estimated the cost of that and realized that it was we're not able to do that within our existing budget, and we did not move forward with an aggressive program of seismic retrofit at that time. What we have done in the last 16 years is we've done phase one retrofit, which, as I said, is relatively inexpensive. So what we've been doing is adding it as work in already programmed repair and strengthening projects. And as I mentioned, some of the OTIA bridges were repaired and strengthened versus replacement, and we were able to add the seismic retrofit, the cables, onto those projects for a relatively small cost. And these 72 that we've done in the last 16 years were done in the bridge program STIP, the regular bridge program. And then, of course, we've added the 6 in the OTIA program. Now, I also mentioned that as we build new bridges, we are definitely building them to seismic standards. And of those 1,155, we have completely replaced 40 in the last 16 years. And those are seismically adequate. And as I mentioned in the OTIA 3 program, we have 150 of those replacements have been done, and they're seismically adequate. So you can see that we've made some progress from our initial prioritization, but we still have a lot of bridges left that have not been retrofitted, nearly 900. And if you look at the progress that we've made in the last 16 years, where we've been able to do about 4 or 5 bridges a year, we estimate that it would take about 219 years to do those remaining bridges. And please compare that to the number I gave you before of 80% likelihood of a major event in the next 50 years. The problem, though, is we actually are not going to be able to make even that kind of progress in 219 years, because the bridge program is reduced by about half the state STIP bridge program in order to pay the bonds back for the OTIA program. So for the next 20 years, when we're doing the OTIA 3 payback, we will be making even less progress on our retrofitting program. Okay, so that gets to the reason for the latest study. And with that kind of backlog, you can imagine that we wanted to know to a higher degree of accuracy which bridges we should be retrofitting. And so we took advantage of a recent computer program that's been developed by Federal Highway Administration, which can actually look at an inventory of bridges, and you can input a certain type of earthquake, like one of Scott's Mills or Klamath Falls or even a Cascadia subduction zone, you could model that earthquake and see what damage results and then estimate the economic losses, because you would not be able to use those highways for freight transport and getting around. So we used that computer program to simulate the six most likely to occur earthquake events in Oregon. And what I've shown here is just a couple of them, two of the ones with the largest damage. One of them, of course, is a Cascadia subduction zone, a 9.0. This would be an earthquake that occurs along the whole Oregon coast and would cause significant damage on US 101. In fact, I was going to report to you just in summary what this study concluded is, if that event happened, there would be dozens of bridge failures on US 101. US 101 would basically not be usable. But even more than that, there would be no state highway between US 101 and I-5 that would be usable. Every one of those state highways would be closed for a significant period of time. Much of I-5 would be unusable. There would be sections where it would be usable, but the problem there is we have a lot of older overpasses that have not been seismically retrofitted. As you know, the UTIA program focused on the mainline bridges, so a lot of those overpasses would collapse and block the lanes on I-5. And then there are a significant number still of older river crossings on I-5 that would be damaged beyond use and would not be able to be used. So you can see we've estimated a fairly large damage cost after that event, and there would be significant economic losses on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. The other event that I showed here was an event along what's called the Portland Hills Fault up in Portland. It runs along the West Hills, sort of parallel to the Willamette River. And if a 7.0 occurred there, even higher damages in the Portland metro area, and again, hundreds of millions of dollars of economic loss. So based on that study, we have come up with some actions and recommendations. And these are my last two slides. I wanted to point out on these first three recommendations, these are actions that ODOT can move forward with our existing resources. We think we need to further refine this latest study that we did and actually pick route segments where we should be concentrating retrofitting dollars rather than the way we've done it now, where we just add it to existing STIP projects. We want to broadly distribute the findings because, frankly, we didn't want to be the only ones that knew that there was going to be a large impact if we had a big earthquake. So one of the things we've done is make a report that could be widely distributed to not only you and the commission, but the public, and you see, you have a copy of that report. And it lays out pretty clearly the risks that are involved. We do want to continue with phase one retrofit. We actually probably cannot make this 4 to 5 bridges a year. As I mentioned, for the next 20 years, we're going to be doing significantly less than that. So those are the three things that we can move forward with. There are also three actions that we felt would be important for the state, which ODOT would need some help to move forward with. The first one is basically a funding issue. Right now, the bridge program, STIP, has a goal of supporting freight mobility, supporting the OTIA 3 program and their routes, and preserving the large investment that we have in our structures in Oregon. So that's our focus. We don't have a focus on seismic retrofit. If we really wanted to address the problem, we would need to add that as a focus in our selection criteria and prioritization. And, of course, we would have to add significant funding to be able to accomplish a more strategic method or prioritization of retrofitting bridges and include phase two. We have lifeline routes. ODOT worked with local agencies and stakeholders back in the mid-90s to establish lifeline routes, which were determined to be priorities at that time for maintaining traffic after an event. There's been a lot of work on bridges and roads in the last 15 years since this was done, and we believe we need to relook at the lifeline routes and reassign them so that they fit the current condition of our bridges. And the last item here is...
Wait till he's done.
Okay, sorry. The last item is ODOT can go forward and refine our current study, but that study focuses on bridges. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of other risks. For instance, landslides on highways is not included in this study and really should be, because that would tend to maybe change where our priorities would be. We have not considered things like fuel depots and access to critical infrastructure that the state would need after a seismic event. We need to take into account hospitals, fire stations, and responders, and we need to have a prioritization that supports the actions that would be taken right after a major event. So those are the three findings that we came up with. And in summary, I'll just say ODOT is concerned about maintaining mobility after an event, and we do feel that the highway network is a critical part of being able to respond to help get people to hospitals, to get food and water and those kind of things to people after an event. And right now, we don't feel like our highway network would come up to be able to accomplish that after a major event. And with that, thank you very much for your attention.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, AV has a lot of this on our mind. The I-35 bridge in Minneapolis, I've been across that bridge, I don't know how many times, and it just collapsed into the river. And I don't even think it had to shake to bit that one to come down. Now, I know you got a lot, there's a lot here. And by the way, I want to chime in on the federal government. This is a great federal job stimulus project, for God's sakes. Imagine how many people we could put to work using Oregon gravel and American steel, retrofitting and rebuilding. Now, when you've done this study, you've recognized and found bridges specifically that have specific needs. Do you have and then you talked about lifelines to communities, which I appreciate that, because do you have a prioritization list of these bridges first? And I every community in this state is important, but you know, obviously I mentioned I-5, 84, you know, maybe 97, whatever. And 101, God bless 101, but I think you're just going to have to, if this happens, we're just going to have to write that off for 200 years probably. They say that's my friend over here, at least getting like, do you have a priority list where we start first?
We do. We have actually two lists. One that was done back in 1997. We consider that list to be old and relatively out of date. It has a numerical priority from 1 to about 4,000, including all the state, city, and county bridges. With this current study, we have a different list, and we limited that list only to the top 15 bridges that we felt needed seismic retrofit. And we did that for a couple of reasons. One is we recognized that with the limited resources we have, we're not really going to be able to go out and do a lot of retrofitting anyway. But we wanted to know if we could focus $35 million on this problem, where would it go? And so we do have that list of the top 15. But one of our recommendations here, you see, is that list was based on a study of only state highways and only the bridges. And in order to have a list that we feel more comfortable with that would have wide stakeholder support, we do believe this number 3 recommendation that a larger study should be done that would include landslides, fuel depots, and a number of other things, maybe revised lifeline routes, so that then we would have a lot more confidence in that top list of 15.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I think our federal government, God bless them, I know if this is a great stimulus project here, right here. So with that, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And I have Representative Doherty and Representative Boone.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And for somebody who drove across the Markham Bridge twice a day to work every day and back after the Scotts Mill earthquake, I thank you because I look at those retrofitted bridges. You mentioned that this was part of your education package. Who has this been distributed to on a city, county, whatever basis?
Right now, it's been made available mostly through the web and nationally, and we've did that through three areas. It's on the ODOT webpage, both the bridge and research. It's on the Dogami webpage under their seismic portion of their webpage, and it was distributed nationally through the Transportation Research Board. That it has a mailing list of about 15,000 people nationwide, and they distribute all research that's done within this country to interested parties.
So do they have to be on a list? What I'm thinking of, I mean, do the engineers in Tigard, and I would assume the engineers in Multnomah County deal with all of the Multnomah County bridges, have this? Or is this something that you would like us to communicate to our cities and counties that this is available?
It was communicated through some public information releases by our Office of Public Relations, and it was actually covered in several of the newspapers. Mm-hmm. But we have not made direct contact through the local governments.
They needed to contact you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, and I'm really, really Representative Boone, not Representative Call. I sit here in my morning committee, and I have this cold, and I took some medication, and it's kind of confusing me. So other than that, but your last, and I was wondering why Representative Benz is so far away. Anyway, your last slide, which talked about the emergency angle of getting people medicine and supplies through and stuff like that. And I think I asked this question in another committee because I sit on emergency preparedness and veterans, and we've talked about this for some time. And I just wonder if anybody is doing a statewide assessment of equipment and opportunities for moving stuff, even right down to who has horses. I mean, not kidding, but because of these the bridge issue and roads that are not going to be drivable, et cetera, nor is there going to be gas even to use your cars.
Chair Beyer, Representative Boone, we do that in a way of more not down to the actual number of pieces of equipment, but down to who the contractors are. So our emergency response plan has a priority for which bridges we're going to go look at, which roads we're going to go look at, make sure that they're still in place, and we go in kind of in a basic order. Again, that's on the state highway system. The concerns that, and so on the state within the state highway system, then we will evaluate what we can do with our resources, and we know what contractors to call that generally do that kind of work. I don't know exactly how many pieces of equipment they have, but we know and have a list of the contractors. A lot of them are small contractors that are relatively small stuff that do work for us, and some of the big construction contractors that have the bigger pieces of equipment that we have that are available to us. I don't have the full listing of resources, and it's really difficult to do that for two reasons that I see. One is that when we work across jurisdictional boundaries, everybody's kind of building their own list, and that's one problem. But the bigger issue is what you need is really dependent on what kind of event you have, and I've never gotten my mind around how to inventory every single thing we could possibly need to cover every single kind of event. So rather than having all of those lists there, we have what we call an all-hazards plan, so we can address any kind of emergency, and we know what we need to go out and get, what kind of information we need to go out and gather, depending on what kind of event we're having. But there's no list that I'm aware of that has each piece of equipment and its availability. We do it by company.
Well, I was wondering if there is even any effort, and I see Dogami in the room too, Dr. O'Connell. As far as getting that kind of information, not that ODOT would have to do it, but maybe working with some of the local municipalities and counties or and local emergency responders to at least get something available so when you say we have this event, we need these kinds of things. Is somebody, is that effort happening, do you know of?
Chair Meyer, Representative Boone, I'm not aware of a coordinated effort to do that. The Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission was is aware of this, and I don't know if they have taken that action. Ms. McConnell may, if, in showing that great cooperation between state agencies. Love to have her join us. If she's so,
she
so
just
inclined.
Indicated that she's available. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the invitation. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries.
God,
and
I made you an Irish
and,
woman.
Sorry. Representative Call, I forgive you for.
I said McConnell, I think.
Chair Beyer and committee members. As Mr. Tindall has said, it's hard to get your arms around all that kind of inventory. However, I will make you aware of some meetings that have been taking place that are being led by the Office of Emergency Management, and that is really looking at developing these comprehensive, and extensive databases of just that kind of information and having it together so that you could mix and match. So maybe it wasn't a seismic event, maybe it's a wind event, and then you would be able to then pull down what's that going to affect, where are we going to have down trees, where, you know, and so those kind of conversations are occurring within the state agencies, and that's actually being built off of a some work done in both Virginia and North Carolina where they have developed these statewide databases to deal with hazards response. And doesn't necessarily have to be natural hazards, but all hazards.
It wasn't a trick question, but I'm forever trying to give that exposure because we really need to be doing that. It sounds like you're working with everybody anyway, as usual. So you guys are great.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last sentence of your program said dedicated seismic retrofitting program. What is that? What would be a dedicated seismic retrofitting program? Does that mean a money that goes into account? We wait 200 years for the event, or what exactly is it?
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, yeah, any sort of dedicated account would be to say that we're going to allot some certain amount of money towards seismic retrofit, whatever that number we would pick out would be. It wouldn't necessarily go into account. It would just say into an account. It would just say This amount is going to be allotted to this specific purpose, much like you do with modernization today.
Follow up.
The idea would be we would go to the, it would move our replacement of those bridges up more rapidly than 200 years. Is that the idea, or would this be something that's held in abeyance waiting for the event?
No. Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, it's proactive. If we allocated that amount of money, we'd just increase the number of bridges that we were seismically retrofitting every year.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, follow up.
The idea then, and when something happens like we've seen happen in Haiti or these other awful things, the idea then is not that we've saved for them, we've tried to prevent damage by the retrofit and all that, but then the idea is the events occurred, we go find the money to fix it, as opposed to saving for the event. Is that the idea?
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, yeah, in the case where we have an event occur, then we're into a reactive mode with whatever we haven't already protected, and the idea of being proactive and investing an amount of money every year that moves us forward is that you'll have less to deal with when you have an event, and so then you'll have less to have to scramble around to find money to fix.
Thank you,
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that we've got two scenarios, and I'm not sure that our approach is addressing either very well. and I'm not on emergency preparedness. But so we have a shaker, which we have, and it's a mild to pretty good shaker, and we lose the Markham Bridge. Huge impact to our economy, a very expensive thing to fix, so it makes sense to go and retrofit the Markham Bridge. And you could do that, and I guess the approach here is, well, let's look at our bridge and see what it would take, bridge by bridge by bridge, to fix them. And we can't get there. You just told us we can't get there. Okay, I get that. So maybe instead of taking and trying to fix all bridges or identify which bridge has which risk, let's maybe I'd feel better if we looked at it in terms of, okay, if we have a shaker, these are the bridges that we need to prioritize, and I think you're doing that. But if we have a major one, it doesn't do us any good to have the Markham Bridge survive and the Terwilliger curves slide off into the river. We haven't gained anything. So it seems to me the price of a, and I'm not saying that this has to come out of ODOT's budget, but for the price of a bridge retrofit, what we really ought to have is sort of a master plan of a major seismic event. How would we get things around using what routes that would avoid the whole, you know, and I guess I'm asking, is that being done? And I guess from the Representative Boone's calls, questions, I would say that the answer is no. And don't you agree that there's kind of two different issues here? We all look at Haiti and say, oh my gosh, and that's one kind of an event that would take a certain kind of, but just going bridge to bridge to bridge to get us through just seems sort of ridiculous.
Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, Vicki will probably want to talk about this as well, but the first thing is we don't have a study of all of those unstable slopes, so we don't really know that yet. We know a little bit about the bridges. The second thing is we can go off and pick a route. I got a couple in mind, but it really depends on what happens during the earthquake, and we can model different locations of or different movements depending on different locations, but exactly where that occurs is going to determine exactly what kind of damage we get. And so I may pick a route that I think is one that's really important and it gets hit really hard, whereas another route that I didn't pick for whatever reason it suffers less damage and is actually easier for me to open.
Follow up.
Yeah, let me follow up with that, because you're absolutely right and I get that. So maybe it isn't a single route, but where do we want to get in a major emergency? In other words, you draw the red lines around hospitals and emergency centers and say, okay, in any event, we need to know, well, here's two different possible routes. If one doesn't work, maybe the other would, and have that kind of a mapping and include local access. And that, that's, I mean, correct. We're also caught up in this. You've got one system. The locals have another system. The counties have another system. And the answer might not be you. It might be something else. So there seems to be a better way. And I didn't know about this crustal earthquake in the hills above Portland, but I can see that would be, I mean, I always worry about the coast, but now I've got another thing to worry about in the middle of the night. I'm all wrapped up in this. So I guess that is, for the cost of one big bridge retrofit, we should be doing this kind of thing in a proactive way to say, okay, in a major event, we need people to get to this hospital, to this food distribution center, to this emergency center. That's sort of the map I want to see drawn.
Chair Beyer and committee members and Representative Berger, and that's precisely the issue, is we can't fix everything. We can't retrofit or fix everything. We don't have enough time or money to deal with this. We can certainly, going forward, we're building smarter, we're doing things right as we go forward, and that's That's fantastic. You're absolutely right, and it really is. I'm looking here at the actions needed, but the number, the second one, update lifeline route designations. That is really the bottom line on, you find those absolute priority locations and areas that have to stay open, and you figure out, and you have you build some redundancy into your system. You always have to have that, and you think about doing that. And we've had these conversations in the emergency, you know, management and preparedness, and talking about the coast now, because since the 2004 Sumatra earthquake and tsunami issue, we've realized just how vulnerable the coastline is and how easy it is to become isolated. And you see again with Haiti that if you don't know where the hospitals are or how to get to them, even if there's one standing, it doesn't make any difference if no one can get to it. So that would be my number one of their suggested actions. And I do want to say that I really appreciate ODOT coming forward, first doing this study and spending time to do it and bringing it into the light of day, having gone through this with Senate Bill 2 and looking at the seismic needs assessment for schools and public emergency facilities. It's not fun to have to sit down and go, oh, this, you know, this is not going to work, and there's going to be issues. But I think we all need to look at that and then not be a doomsday. Don't say we can't do anything. Think about what we can do, and then we should do it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you for coming. Thank you for the presentation, the uplifting presentation. Yeah. Yes, and thank you for joining us today. It was great to have you here, and we know we every once in a while we have to come to reality. You know,
Madam Chair.
Yes,
visit me. I will not sleep tonight thinking about that crustal earthquake possibility on the West Hills because my grandchildren live up there.
Madam Chair, we didn't even talk about what happens if Mount Hood erupts. So. Yeah.
Madam Chair, what is this about letting all these engineers off the hook? They get to sit there and everybody else, they just sit there and smile. And, and Mr. Tindall takes care of everybody.
He's the one that works when these things happen.
Yeah.
And before I adjourn, I just want to let you know that we don't have any work for Friday, so we will not be meeting on Friday, and hopefully we'll have our Senate bills and ready to go on Monday, and we are adjourned.
I